Good morning, Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Excited to be here with you this Wednesday morning. It is nice out there right now, Matt Neely. It has cooled off quite a bit in the last couple days since my last Morning Voice over here. Got to take that drive down to the Bustos Media Studio with the windows down for a little while there until I remembered I was on Alvernon and that secondhand fentanyl smoke might leak into my car in some capacity.
Where's that Surgeon General's warning?
Right? I'm a little concerned about that one. Smoke-free Arizona just doesn't seem to apply these days on Alvernon. But anyway, lots going on in the Old Pueblo this week. University of Arizona, of course, first day of classes on Monday. So students filling the town, filling our restaurants. We're really excited to see them, of course. Kind of disturbing to read that U of A enrollment was down 20% this year as well, too. 20%. Like, what do you think that is? Well, what's the cause of that one there, Matt?
No idea.
Is it the lack of value in college education, perhaps?
Are student loans more expensive?
Yeah, maybe going six-figure student loans for an English major or something that just isn't going to have a financial payoff suddenly like ringing into kids' ears? Or maybe ChatGPT is just answering all the questions for them.
Well,
I actually worry about this.
You may have a point there.
Like, I wonder if the long-term viability of college education is going to have a downward effect on admissions in the U of A and what effect that might have on Tucson's economy. It's certainly something to think about and something to consider. There's quite a bit of action, though, going on in the Old Pueblo this week. We had, first and foremost, the IFL Championship game this last Saturday at the Tucson Arena. That's the TCC. It's the first of a three-year deal for Arena Football to house their championship game here in Tucson. And I was pretty excited to see that game, 64-61, the final, as the Vegas Nighthawks defeated the Green Bay Blizzard. Jaden Delora, ex-U of A quarterback, had a fantastic game. It was great to see him here in the Old Pueblo. Jed Fish was in the house as well, too. Former University of Arizona football coach was here in Tucson to say hi to Jaden and some of the old players and whatnot as well, too. So it was great to see him back in the house over here. And we've got, of course, U of A football coming up this weekend as well, too.
Indeed.
Our first game Saturday night, the University of Arizona Stadium, 7:30 p.m. We're a 16.5 point favorite. I'm not so sure if we can talk about gambling here on the radio, but if not, I'm so sorry.
Just did, so
we can delete that one out. But I'm excited to see the Wildcats coming back to Tucson. I hear that stadium naming rights are still out there as
you
well,
know that
too.
That's, you know, I'm surprised it didn't happen. I'm surprised it hasn't happened yet. However, you know that's, I mean, it's all about the Benjamins.
Yes. You know what I think would be the most ironic would be like if something from Project Blue or Beale Infrastructure took the name of the stadium, the irony would not escape me right there. That would be the biggest win for Amazon Web Services right there. So if you want to go for that naming rights.
The hatred from the community coming out on that one would just be hilarious.
Amazing, right? It would be pretty neat to see for sure.
Well, you know, they went ahead with the TEP arrangement. I put it in the news today. So for them, nothing changed except for that plot of land is now not in the city of Tucson, but otherwise they're still like, looks like they're still proceeding ahead.
Right. They're moving forward with the infrastructure to have it ready to take that kind of power distribution in the future. So I have a feeling that they're still moving ahead and eventually, with the right campaign contributions, the right stadium naming rights in some capacity, that Project Blue and this giant data center is still going
to
come.
Just please don't go to Blue AstroTurf because I think that's a one-off for
Boise
for
State
Boise
University.
State. I don't want to see it.
You know, those ones
I don't
actually
like the AstroTurf to begin with. I'd rather have them playing on grass again. But
the Blue AstroTurf at Boise State actually really is off-putting to a lot of fans. When those games are on TV, I will often have fans, you know, sitting at Union Public House stop me and say, hey, can you adjust the color on the TV over here? Something is actually wrong with that. And so we've got a very pretty field at Arizona Stadium, and I'm excited for one to have this one come back to the Old Pueblo. A little tailgate action as well, too. That starts 6 hours before the game, which means that you can legally have an open container of an adult beverage on the University of Arizona Mall starting at 1:30 p.m. So I might see some of our listeners down there as well, too, and I get an opportunity to say hi. Also coming up, it looks as if the RTA board has voted 8-0. That was a unanimous vote with one abstention to move RTA Next forward. It's been forwarded to the Board of Supervisors, who on September 2nd are going to vote to decide if that plan for a continuation, we can't even really call it a continuation, a new half-cent sales tax for the next 20 years to fund our local infrastructure and roads. On September 2nd, the Board of Supervisors are going to vote if whether or not that's going to be on a March ballot. And I'm guessing, given the political connections right now on that RTA board, that that one is going to pass the Board of Supervisors. And this will end up being a special election for us in March. And so that's one to keep an eye on over here, because the roads really do depend on us having some sort of long-term plan, because there is no cavalry coming behind us to save us, as Ted Maxwell would say.
And they put in the provision to a significant chunk of money, $250 million, to finish up what they started on RTA part uno.
Yeah. Right. And so this one is kind of a big deal. There's still going to be some opportunity for public input, but obviously big changes on that RTA board. The city, in naming Mike Ortega as the new head of the RTA board, have really got the control that they want to manipulate that plan to make sure that it's at least a plus one in terms of dollars in terms of investment in infrastructure inside the city of Tucson. And so with the city being on board, I think we're going to see the municipalities get along at least enough to get this one onto the ballot. And we'll see if voting for another half cent sales tax increase, something that hasn't exactly had a lot of success in the last two special elections, makes it across the finish line in March of 2026. So do keep an eye on that. And some recent heartbreaking business news: Summit Hut announces it's closing its last location here in Tucson. They had just closed the online and the outdoor retailer that was sort of Tucson's version of REI, for lack of a better explanation for those who don't know.
REI is the national version of Summit Hut.
Truly.
Let's throw Summit Hut a bone on that one.
When I moved to Tucson in 1995, yeah, Summit Hut to me was just about the pinnacle of coolest store that could have possibly existed.
And I mean, you'd go in there and everybody you spoke to was familiar with the trails that people hiked on here. They could give you solid advice. I'm just very sad to see them go. It's just a really good company and very strong connections, and people who knew what they were talking about, knew what they were selling, knew their products, knew the terrain around here, and a great community they built. So very, very sad to see them go.
Without a doubt, it shows what happens with local retail these days. Summit Hut was just too big to be supported by just locals, and not big enough to compete against the REIs of the world and the online retailers of the world in this particular space. But what a giant they were for an awful long time here in Tucson, guiding people out to the trails, really like helping foster a love for the outdoors and the Sonoran Desert,
right,
in general.
Which Tucson markets as one of its big tourism draws, right?
Right.
And it's like that. It's a Baum's Sporting Goods, a long time, again, locally owned. They've outfitted baseball, softball teams, and they closed several years ago. But it's hard to see this because it's a well established company that did a lot of good work by Tucsonans, I think.
Without a doubt. And so heartbreaking news that they're announcing the closing of their Speedway location, which will be their last store here in the Old Pueblo. We are really going to miss the community-involved outdoor retailer that was Summit Hut. Thank you for giving Tucson decades and decades of an amazing experience and introducing city slickers like myself to the outdoors. In other political news, Sadie Shaw lost her lawsuit against the city and the county recorder to overturn the election results and possibly have a whole nother election, which would have cost $350,000 or $400,000 to the county to run. But the recount is still going on. We should get some results, I believe, by the end of this week.
Today and tomorrow. And if the pattern holds true, that there would have been a last Friday read in the unveiling it in court. So I guess that would happen this Friday.
Yep. And so we will find out who will be the Democrat challenger for Ward 3 here to go up against J.L. Wittenbraker in just possibly the next few hours or certainly the next few days. We got a great show coming up for you over here. I got lots of guests today. After the break, we're going to bring on Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza, owners of Perletta Pacifico. After that, we're going to have City Councilman Jay Tolkoff's going to call in. He's got an update from Ward 6 and what's going on in the city of Tucson and with your city council. We're going to have Greg Pemberton. He happens to be the union chief of the city of Washington, D.C.'s police department.
Union,
and we're going to talk about some relations between what's going on in D.C. and what's happening in the Tucson police force. And as well, we're going to have some representatives from the Girl Scouts coming up to bring up the second hour. So we got a great show over here on The Morning Voice.
I hope they bring cookies.
Yeah, without a doubt. Don't go anywhere. We're going to have Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza, owners of La Perla del Pacifico, coming up after the break. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. Every week, we love to bring you exciting content, local news, politics, business, and of course, my favorite, the restaurant industry. And I have the great fortune of being joined live in the KVOI studios right now by a couple of budding young entrepreneurs, the owners and operators of La Perla del Pacifico restaurant on 22nd, Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey,
thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for taking part of your Wednesday to join us on The Morning Voice. Why don't you guys break down where and what your restaurant is? Where are you guys located?
Well, it's on 22nd Craycroft, and it's called La Perla del Pacifico. Before us, there was a restaurant called Mariscos Mi Mazatlán. And as I was telling you earlier, Tucson is known as the Old Pueblo. Mazatlan is known as La Perla del Pacifico, the Pacific Pearl. That's where the name came from. And I'll let Paul go on with a little bit of history about La Perla del Pacifico.
Yeah, so thank you again, Grant, for having us here today. We're excited to share this news with Tucson. I think Tucson is known by our food. So we're excited to be part of this community and bring maybe a new twist or concept to mariscos or seafood from our Mexican culinary community and everything like that.
I love it. It's always a big entrepreneurial risk to get out there and start your own restaurant, right? It's a lot of money. It's a lot of work. Yeah. It's a lot of stress. How did you guys get your start in the restaurant industry?
Well, Paul, my background is finance, and that's what I mainly do at the restaurant. I figure out, this is Caesar, by the way, Cesar, and I manage the monies and the resources. We make sure that the inventory is there and, you know, all the boring stuff. But we also get to know all our patrons. And as we were going down this business, because I'm in the finance business, Paul came to me one day and said, hey, I have this new idea, new concept. Why don't we tag along? Why don't we go visit this restaurant that's going to be, there's an opportunity here. So he invited me to this new venture.
As an entrepreneur for like 10 years, you never know when the opportunity is going to show up or what is going to happen. But I think the restaurant industry has always been something that I've been passionate about, or I always saw myself kind of owning a restaurant. So when this opportunity came along, I spoke to Seth and I'm like, hey, you know, I think it's a good opportunity for us to jump into this and probably bring something different to Tucson, not to reinvent the wheel, but make it a little bit better. What can we actually bring? And food is a great connector, right? It's a form to be able to communicate with different community members, just different people, cultures. And I feel that's what we're trying to bring with La Perla.
I love it. So you guys announced a grand opening on June 27th, but you were in the space a little bit before then, right?
Correct, yeah. So we were trying to find our footing, right? I think as an entrepreneur or a restaurateur, like you might know, is by trial and error, right? Like figure out like what the customer wants. Maybe we fell in love with one type of menu, but our customers were like, no, we really don't want that, or we want to change it. And since as I mentioned, with the history of that spot being open for so many years and having a loyal customer base, so we're trying to figure out, okay, how can we rebrand it to honor what it was there before us, and at the same time give it a better twist or a better flavor, I guess, to bring it back.
So Mariscos can be a tough draw in Tucson, right? Certainly a very popular culinary concept, particularly in Mexico and for Mexicans. I lived in Mexico for 11 years, had a restaurant down in San Carlos, Nuevo Guaymas, so I know a thing or two about mariscos, right? But it can be kind of considered tough in the old Pueblo. A lot of people say, well, you're landlocked in the desert. How do you get fresh seafood? Yeah. What are your secrets to bringing fresh mariscos into La Perla del Pacifico?
Well, now that you mention San Carlos, one of our best plates is pargo frito, the red snapper.
Yep.
And we bring it from that area, from the area of Guaymas, Empalme, San Carlos. We bring it fresh. We have a direct supplier. So, you know, it's literally from the ocean to your plate. And that's what we try to bring, some original plates. And you'd be amazed how many people actually like seafood and the type of seafood that we bring. So we try to bring it fresh, of course. That red snapper is one of our main plates there.
I love it. That's a great dish.
No, and I think, I'm sorry to interrupt, but like you mentioned, it's always, I'm never aware of what is available to you until you jump into this type of industry, right? And the relations you have and knowing about the freshness or the product that is available to actually have a good seafood plate in the desert is amazing that we can provide that.
We used to always get Guaymas shrimp, right? And it used to be even named on menus like 10 or 20 years ago. It was so common. And over the years, the catch of shrimp in Guaymas has gotten less and less and less every year as technology has gotten better and better, right? We've been able to use GPS in ways to sweep every bit of the floor of the Sea of Cortez to make sure that we haven't missed a spot at all. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem like that's a growth industry, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to keep in mind that seasonal. And the season opens September, October, November, December. So you have to bring the shrimp from other locations, the same thing from octopus. So it's the octopus is brought sometimes from Spain because the season is closed up in Mexico. So it really depends on where you're going to bring the oysters, from the East Coast or the West Coast. So it's a seasonal situation and you have to be up in the trends and, you know, you have to talk to your suppliers also. Sometimes the cost goes up on oysters and it gets really expensive, but we must keep the same prices consistently. But one of the things that I enjoy the most is talking to the people that visit us, just talking to them. And it's such a beautiful thing that they give you really good feedback about your food, about the location. And something that's Paul and I, we talk constantly about how are these conversations going, that they like, what they don't like. For instance, when we came in, the menu was long. I mean, really, really long. And that's not the trend. You need to keep it easy. You have to keep it simple for the people coming in. So we had to reduce that menu from, let's say, 130 products down to about 60, 65 products.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. There's certainly something to be said about doing a few things really well rather than trying to be all things to all people. And it's a common problem.
Yeah,
that restaurateurs have over here. And we're speaking with Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza, for those that are just joining in, owners of La Perla del Pacifico. But what happens is we're scaredy cats, right? When all of our guests say, I love that dish, that's my favorite, don't ever get rid of that. We hold on to it, right? Sometimes for months or years. And in your head, you're like, this is the best dish. Like, I can never get rid of this. And then you just keep adding.
Uh-huh.
And adding to your menu. And pretty soon, you've got like this 9-page menu, like the Cheesecake Factory, right? There's a Jack Furrier Western Tire Care Center ad between like page 4 and 5. And you're like, what's going on over here with this? And so I think it's really sage advice, Cesar, to reduce that menu, do a few things, and do them great.
Yeah,
right. And that's easy to say when you have, you know, 15 years of experience like yourself. But in our case, you know, we had to come in and we had to talk to a lot of people to come to the conclusion, aim, this menu is really, really long. You guys need to shorten it up. And we took the time. It took a little bit, like a month to reduce it, but we're down to what we do best.
Yeah. And I think it's just going back and you know, for us and anybody that might think of going into the restaurant industry, lean on other entrepreneurs or your staff, right? Like they know best, like what is the, you know, the best play that you can actually sell. But for us, even at this very moment, we still have a lot of repeated customers that are like, oh, they used to have this. You know, can you make it? I was like, no, we're no longer that brand. We are completely new, and this is what we're making now. I was like, it might not be the same, but trust us and taste it. So it's just getting that comfort back to the customer, or just like make them feel, hey, I'm gonna come back and try this new play. But it is hard. It is hard for you, and it's scary, like you mentioned, to see, because at one point you want to satisfy every single palate, but unfortunately you can't. It's just finding who is going to be your customer.
Without a doubt. And I think it really helps for us to specialize. You don't want to have a menu with 120 items. Yeah. You probably don't need chicken and waffles or spaghetti at Pacifico, right? There comes a point where you're like, just because I could put that on the menu doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Absolutely.
That's fantastic. You guys have done a great job thus far, and the reviews have been fantastic for a restaurant like this. I think there's a big Sonoran influence in Tucson that just loves mariscos, no?
It is. It is. And I think one of our biggest priorities has always been, like Cesar just mentioned, is just take care of the customers, what we have, and to be able to provide good food that is going to be something that's going to be memorable for you, and of course the experience, right? What is the experience you're going to have when you come and dine with us?
I love it. Well, let's take a quick break over here. We're going to have more action coming up from Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza, owners of Perla del Pacifico. More exciting restaurant talk when we come back on The Morning Voice. This is Grant Kruger. You're listening to 1030 AM, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m. on The Morning Voice, we're bringing you local content. One of my favorite things is how we get to talk so many things related to the Old Pueblo over here. On Mondays, you've got Lydia Aranda. On Tuesdays, General Ted Maxwell from the Southern Arizona Leadership Council, and he always brings in his great engagement hour and local hard-hitting politicians. On Wednesdays, you get me, Food for Thought, the intersection of business and politics. On Thursdays, you've got Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attraction Alliance. And on Fridays, Dr. Ed Ackerley bringing you wonders from the University of Arizona. But right now, we are blessed to have these budding young entrepreneurs joining us for another segment. It's Mr. Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza, owners of Perla del Pacifico, located on 22nd Street. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, so give me a little bit more inspiration on Perla del Pacifico. Why did you guys choose mariscos? And in so many Mexican restaurants here in Southern Arizona, like what gave you the gusto to go out there and start this concept specifically?
You know what? I think when we think about mariscos, I think we always think about them in a linear way, kind of like same plates and different restaurants, just different plating concepts, anything like that. But being able to travel around Mexico and being in different parts and tasting different seafood and different concepts that are completely different to what we know from Sonora or Sinaloa, that's kind of one of the ideas that we had, and bringing in and creating something that is more unique in the plating, that flavors, the taste, the collaborations that we're going to do, or the ideas that are coming up, and just kind of trying to bring something different to the seafood world, and especially here in Tucson.
One of the things that I always struggle with, guys, is that balance between authenticity and what people here in Southern Arizona want, right? As someone that also operates a Mexican restaurant here in Reforma, I get people all the time that complain, well, we want authentic. And I'm like, well, do you really want chapulín asado, like dried grasshoppers, on your guacamole? Because if you go to Mexico City, this is how it's coming.
It's legitimately
authentic, but yet I might get a call from the health department.
Yeah.
How do you guys balance that, you know, between authenticity and what people want?
It's because seafood or mariscos, they're just great. They're good. It's tasty. It's something original also. And like, for instance, the molcajete. The molcajete, and it's, how can I describe it? A hot stone. It's a lava stone with bacon-wrapped shrimp, grilled shrimp, grilled octopus, and roasted chicken, and some fajitas. It's a traditional plate. It's good. It's tasty. And the way we present it is with the lava stone. So being traditional is actually good because it is original. That's the way you, the same plate that we serve here is the same plate they serve in Mexico. So having that presentation is actually pretty good. I went to school in the University of Sonora, and I traveled around Sonora. I traveled around different states of Mexico. And I know the seafood industry. I love seafood. And plus, my father was originally from Mazatlan, Sinaloa. So we know the taste. We know the areas. Like I said, Empalme, Sonora, Guaymas, San Carlos, that's my backyard. And I know the people. I know the suppliers. So what you're getting is real Mexican food.
I love it. Hey, speaking of Sonora, real quick, we're getting a baseball team here.
Yeah,
in Tucson,
we are.
Right? Like, as somebody that spent a lot of time in Sonora, had season tickets to the Naranjeros from Hermosillo back in the day. We could see ex-Diamondback Oribe Durazo and some of those guys play on those teams. What do you guys think about the Tucson baseball team and us having a Liga del Pacifico team here?
I think that's amazing. I think Tucson, I think we all were craving something to come in and just a sport venue that is going to allow us to connect more, to be able to cheer besides the U of A here, right? That we all like, we're waiting for basketball season, football season, softball, baseball. But I think having something that is like for all of us and to be able to represent us, I think that's amazing.
Cesar, tell the listeners how big baseball really is, this Liga del Pacifico here in the northern states of Mexico.
Oh my gosh, it is huge. It's like the NFL or the Major League Baseball. And the feeling that you go when you go to a baseball game, and you go to a baseball game here in Arizona with the Diamondbacks, and it's great. It's awesome. You feel it. But in a Mexican baseball, La Liga del Pacifico, when you go to a game, it's a party. Every inning, every in between, everything is a party. Everyone's having fun. Everyone's drinking. Everyone's part of the baseball game. And that's the beauty of it. And, you know, you could have your own shirt, and it's not even part of a baseball team. You could be from Empalme, Sonora, or Guaymas that they don't have, but you can have a jersey of Guaymas.
They had the oyster guys.
Right? So it is a big party. And everyone comes together. Let's say Obregón and Hermosillo, in this case Hermosillo and Tucson, are going to face each other. But people from Obregón, people from Puerto Peñasco or Guaymas might come with their own jerseys, and it's part of the game. It doesn't have to be one against the other. And it is just a big party. And guys, girls, older guys like myself and younger people, it attracts everybody.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And we saw the impact, right, of the Liga del Pacifico when they come and play those games here for that weekend. Then
the UA Mexican Baseball Fiesta.
And it got involved. Now having that as a recurrent or being part of that season, I think that's an amazing asset for Tucson.
Yeah, I'm really excited. That season starts, I want to say, the 17th of October, too. And it's not that far away. I mean, we're almost to September right now, guys. So, I mean, we're looking at 6 weeks right now. We're going to have Liga del Pacifico baseball here in Tucson, just down the street from your restaurant as well, too.
Yeah. More than what, I've finished the game and come over and get some of my East Coast.
I love it. So tell me some of your favorite dishes of your restaurant. Like, what should the guests get out there? Like, if you're coming to the Perlin del Pacifico, like, what's the jam?
I know what you're going to say.
So when we were in conversations, I'll like be able to take purchase the restaurant and go into it. The first dish that I tried there was the seafood rice. Think about it as paella made with Mexican rice and cooked with different types of seafood. It's amazing. I can eat that every single day. It's great. That to me, I love food, but that it made me. I was like, wow, this is like amazing. This is really good. So we kept that in the
of
menu.
Course, if it's a winner, like why mess with success over here? Yeah. Right?
And in my case, I'm torn between two of them. Our typical dish that's what we most sells is our pargo frito, our red snapper, our fried red snapper, and it's a whole fish, and it's fried, and it's really good. It comes with a bed of rice and some ensaladas. Additional to that, it's the molcajete that I was talking about, el molcajete barbarroja. It's really between those two. One day it's one's the best, and you know, you taste the most recent, but I know, I think this is best.
Yeah, well, we incorporated a new dish that I think is really good. It's a ribeye aguachile. So it's a ribeye steak, and then it's curated with an aguachile sauce on top with cucumber and avocado on it. Is just like it's amazing as well too.
Fantastic. How are you guys handling all the increase in food costs and whatnot we've had over the last couple of years? There's been some real challenges. As the finance guy.
We try to adjust inventory, meaning just in time, not buying as much inventory unless there is a special going on. Like for instance, normally we buy, let's say, 100 red snappers. And they called me, hey, Cesar, if you buy 200, you'll get them at a special discount if you buy them cash. So we're trying to manipulate the cost of our goods with buying in bulk or buying just in time, just enough to have what we need for a week or two. And that's a difficult thing to juggle because prices are creeping up for the last year, and we have to maintain our prices the same because it's expensive to go out. Let's not call it any other way. And mariscos, they're not cheap.
Right. It's, I mean, you've got a base ingredient alone. Fish, seafood protein is expensive on a base level, no matter what restaurant you're going to.
Yeah. So we need to keep the prices steady as we buy with our inventory or with our suppliers. And it's a juggling situation that we need to keep our prices competitive. And we're very, very competitive with our prices.
I love it. Well, I look forward to getting a chance to visit your restaurant again over there and check out these delicious mariscos at La Perla del Pacifico. Why don't we take a quick break and I hear from a couple of our local advertisers over here. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about challenges of operating inside the city of Tucson. You guys are located on 22nd here. There can certainly be some interesting business challenges. Let's discover some of those when we come back after the break. You're listening to Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza, owners of Perla del Pacifico, and Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. We are joined for one more segment this morning by Cesar Torres and Paul Mendoza, owners of La Perla del Pacifico restaurant located at 22nd and Craycroft. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, before the break, I was teasing the idea that being in Midtown, right, and I've got a shop not that far down the street from you in the Maverick over there at Grant and Tanga Verde, like there are certainly some challenges inside the city of Tucson these days operating a business. Give me a rundown about some of the things that you guys are going through on the streets right now over on 22nd.
No doubt. And I appreciate you asking that difficult question. We all know what's happening in our streets with homeless people. And we try to navigate that situation being respectful. How can I have a Christian heart and attend these people at the same time them being respectful? And that's a difficult thing to juggle, you know, helping them out, but at the same time asking them to be respectful. And it's something that it's been developing little by little. They're understanding the concept. They'll go behind, they'll ask for water, and we'll help out. Definitely, because we want to treat everyone in a very humane way, but at the same time having them respect our the people that come and visit us.
Yeah, and I think it's like Sister said, and you know, you yourself being a business owner as well, and being in this industry for many years, or any business owner that's in Tucson right now, you know, like as a business owner, you want to protect your assets, you want to protect your business. And you want to provide a great experience for your customers, right? Like for them to feel safe or come in or just feeling welcome. But at the same time, like as I said, you don't want to judge anybody or not trying to help anybody. But at the same time, it's kind of finding that good balance between being an entrepreneur or business owner and being a human being, right? To be able to respect them and trying to help them as much as you can. But at the same time, kind of what type of like ambiance you're trying to create for your customers, for them to want to come into your doors and consume your products or your service. So it's just kind of that fine line, but I think there's definitely challenges I think that we as a community or a city need to work on for us to be able to help not just them that are in need of help, but us as entrepreneurs as well too, that we need that support from the city for us to be able to operate and be able to provide a service to our community through our business.
Well said, Bob.
Yeah, well said, for sure. I mean, the city of Tucson has had a number of challenges, you know, major shortages on the police force over here, morale and that sort of industry. We're actually going to get a call in at about 8:15 on the next hour over here from the head of the police union of Washington, D.C. to talk about what they've got going on over there and how some of that might mirror Tucson.
Yeah, D.C.
It's a real, real challenge here in the city for sure. How are you guys doing on staffing? That's been a big topic of conversation over this last couple of years in the restaurant business. There's not enough staff. Nobody wants to work. Nobody wants to get out there and do that. How are you guys finding the staffing market out there?
Well, Paul's doing a really good job there. That's part of his job, you know, reeling people in, and he's done a really good job. I think the girls up front are doing great. The cooks are consistent with their plates, and we also serve. Paul and I clean. We serve. We charge.
As any good restaurateur should, guys. Yeah. This is how it goes.
Yeah. No, I think, you know what? Fortunately, I guess, we haven't seen a shortage of people coming into our doors and looking for a job. Maybe it's because we're fairly new and then it's kind of the name getting out there and just kind of recognizing. But I feel definitely what I've seen, and with my background of business consulting and helping and recruiting and HR and everything like that, is definitely the culture, right, that you want to build in within your four walls in your business. But there are a lot of opportunities out there. I think it's just finding the right person for the right role and providing them with an actual plan of be able to grow. What if you start here and we execute X, Y, and Z, then this opportunity is going to be able to come for you. So are you willing to take that? Are you willing to do that job? But I think it's a conversation you need to have before you bring somebody into your company for them to know that there is opportunity for them to be able to grow with you. And if you establish that from the beginning, then you can actually maximize the time that they're with you. The costs of labor, it would be way cheaper because you're hiring or promoting within and try and bring somebody from the outside, and you can create that funnel of talent that will continue to flow to that. And I think one of the biggest things that I've learned in my years in doing this, there's a local business owner as well too that has created an amazing culture of working for him, that even his staff now are recruiters for him to bring people in. So I think if you do that and you teach you create that culture, then your own staff will bring talented people to work with you and they'll stay with you.
Yeah, that's what we've seen, that the same people bring other people similar to them to their workplace. Yeah,
I wish I had
good, very good communication between, it's not the servers and the guys in the back. No, everyone's a team. People washing the dishes, everyone's a team. Everyone's a team player. And sometimes the dishwashers will go up front to help the girls. That's what we want to see. There's no bickering. Sometimes when it gets really busy, the tents goes up a little bit, the heating, but it's not personal. They know it, that, we just have to do the job as best we can.
Without a doubt, if you can create raving fans amongst your staff and they can recruit other team members for you, you are absolutely winning in this industry as well too, guys.
Yeah.
Hey, we've only got a couple more minutes left here in this segment. Break it down for me, Paul, one more time about where you guys are located. Where can people interact with the Perla de Pacifico?
All right, perfect. So you can visit us on 22nd and Craycraft. Our address is 5601 East 22nd Street. We're there open Monday through Thursday from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. You can find us on social media, Instagram, La Perla del Pacifico Tucson, Facebook as well. And then our website is laperlatucson.com.
And if it's easier for you just to call in, you could call La Perla del Pacifico at 520-790-2255. 520-790-2888. Once again, 520-790-2888. La Perla del Pacifico.
Amazing, guys. I can't wait to get out there and get my wife and family to come try out Perla del Pacifico, visit you guys over on 22nd and Craycroft. You've gotten through the summer months over here.
I know.
You did your grand opening in June. So I trust me, things are going to get a little rosier, I think, here in October when this weather gets better. And I salute you guys for taking that entrepreneurial risk to go out there and open your own restaurant. And also, thank you for coming to spend part of your Wednesday morning with us here on The Morning Voice.
Thank you.
No, thank you for giving us the opportunity and the platform. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And listeners, don't go anywhere. We've got a really engaging second hour of The Morning Voice coming up. We're going to have Jay Tolkoff, candidate for Ward 6, Tucson City Council, Craig Pemberton from the D.C. Police Union, and the CEO of the Girl Scouts, all coming up on hour two of The Morning Voice. You're listening to Grant Krueger on 10:30 a.m., your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to hour two of The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Krueger. You know, I love talking local restaurants. It was pretty great to have Paul and Cesar on over there from Perla del Pacifico. I'm excited to go
the
give
joy
that
they
one
bring
a
to their work is just evident.
They're really excited about that one. And I love people opening up businesses in Midtown Tucson, making things happen over there. And speaking of Midtown Tucson, we've got a caller on the line right now, Mr. Jay Tolkoff. He's going to be your candidate, the Republican candidate for Ward 6 of the Tucson City Council, having just won the Republican primary earlier this month. Good morning, Jay.
Hey, Grant. How are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Voice today.
My pleasure.
Congratulations on your primary win. We're excited for you to give it a go up against Miranda Schubert in that Ward 6 primary on November 4th. You've got your work cut out for you. A lot of campaigning over the next couple months, huh?
It's getting pretty busy. You know, I kind of laid low during the primaries, but it's ramping up. The schedule is busier and busier. I seem to have less time to do things that I would want to do, and I'm doing the things that I have to do to get into a position where I can actually help the citizens of Tucson.
One of the things that we've discussed before in the past is the passing last year of Arizona House Bill 2721 that goes into effect on January 1, 2026. So if you win this particular election as our city councilman, you would have to deal with the housing rules that are coming into law right on January 1st. Can you break that down a bit for our listeners?
Yeah, actually, I spent a couple hours on the phone with some Arizona legislators yesterday trying to get the background because, you know, one of the things I find is that, you know, in places like Tucson, we just don't like being told what to do on high. And for some reason, and I'm sure it was had a lot to do with the fact that we all know there's a housing crisis across the country, that the legislature felt, you know, we've got to do something. And, you know, special interest groups get involved and they push for different things and people's buttons get pushed and politics plays. And all of a sudden we have the state saying that every single municipality across Arizona has to figure out a new zoning area of the city where we're going to increase density as far as how many units can be put on a lot and basically cramming more people into an area of a town that right now might be a very well-established neighborhood. So, to put it in a nutshell, the cities have to identify a central business district, and then they have to draw a mile border around that, and that will be the new area. And one would think that most jurisdictions would say, well, we don't want the state telling us what we have to do. So they would identify the smallest area that they could that would meet the standard of a central business district and put this high density zoning into as little area as possible as they could.
This is duplexes, triplexes, and fourplexes that will essentially be kind of allowed, not allowed, but basically forced to be allowed inside the city located within 1 mile of that central business district, correct?
That's correct. And it's not just that. It is it's townhomes also. So, you could have a string of townhomes put into a lot next to you. And the restrictions for setbacks right now is if you have a house that, you know, you live in a neighborhood, you can't build within so many feet of your property line so that your neighbors have privacy. Well, they're changing those setback requirements, and this is not specified by the state regulations. This is something that Tucson is doing on its own. They're reducing the lot size that are required for the number of units. And the long and short of it, for instance, on a property that I have, it's about 12,000 square feet, which is, you know, kind of about a standard size lot throughout Tucson. My neighbor's house, they could actually tear down their house and put a two-story building within a matter of feet to my property line, and build a fourplex or a sixplex, which would significantly change the neighborhood. So, like I say, this is an attempt to try to bring in lower cost housing, so that that we have more people living close to where the jobs are, and the intent is good, but the reality is for some reason that Tucson has decided that this is going to be an opportunity for them to make a central business district that is enormous compared to, let's say, Phoenix. The central core district that they've decided to increase this density, the way it's proposed right now, extends from approximately Wetmore to Silver Lake, which is 29th Street, and then from Silver Bell to Country Club. Now, compared to the 4x4 square area that they've identified in downtown Phoenix, I'm estimating it's 3 to 4 times the size, and for the life of me, I can't understand what their objective is, other than this, this is kind of goes in line with this whole new idea of we need to have more people and it's closer to the city center, and essentially do away with the need for cars and go for mass transit. And it's all part of this whole idea of Tucson that this leadership seems to be pushing on us. And I am looking there with an objective lens saying, the people of Tucson aren't asking for this. And I think it's time that the people of Tucson realize what's going on and start saying, hey, we need to protect our neighborhoods. Now, of course, the city of Tucson always has meetings and surveys and things like that where people can put their input in. And there are actually three going on this week, two by virtual Zoom meeting type things. One happened yesterday. There's an in-person meeting today at the Donald Lincoln Center, which is on North 6th Avenue, just south of Grant Road at 5:30. And then there's another virtual meeting tomorrow evening. And, I'm planning to be there. And I've got a group of neighbors that are concerned about the impact on their neighborhoods. This is going to impact the historic neighborhoods like Barrio Historico, Anita, the Sam Hughes neighborhoods. I mean, it's a lot of neighborhoods on the west side in the historic areas of town. And I just can imagine what can happen when all of a sudden, we've got basically mini dorms or mini apartments that are being set up right in our central neighborhoods that, historically are one-story buildings and kind of create the personality that Tucson is. So we got a bunch of neighbors that are going to show up. We've got T-shirts that are printed up that I'll be giving away that they preserve our neighborhoods. And we're trying to send a message that, we don't want this huge area. And that message is not being heard by the leaders of the city. They're moving full speed ahead down this this road to, just change the whole dynamics of what makes Tucson, Tucson.
Without a doubt, Jay, I appreciate you bringing this so much shocking news to the table for us over here to really understand just how big that central business designation is, how the city of Tucson has drawn this out, and then they get 1 mile from that to basically be exempt from all of these different zoning regulations as well, too. This could be a really shocking and dramatic change to the infrastructure and the character of the city of Tucson.
Unquestionably. And the worst part about it is I'm kind of seeing this pattern, and I don't like it, and I've lived here for almost 5 decades. I've seen this pattern of where the city leadership seems to be, they seem to have these plans for Tucson that kind of get dropped on us at last minute, most recently Project Blue. And, you know, I'm not going to say I was for Project Blue or against Project Blue because I didn't have enough information to make a decision, but you know, the outcry from the city was, what do you mean you're you know, doing this huge project and we're just finding about it at the last minute? Well, this is the same thing. This was approved, or I shouldn't say approved, it was signed by the governor back in May of 2024. City's been working on it for over a year, and they only started to get minor public input within the last couple of months. It's like, and, you know, the original areas that were drawn out were relatively small. And then they're claiming that the people of Tucson want this area to be bigger. And I'm sorry, I haven't met one person in the city that says, yeah, I want my neighborhood to, you know, go from a bunch of single family residences to a bunch of small, you know, essentially apartment complexes. So I don't know where they're getting this information. I don't know where they're getting that feedback. And you know, I'm sure there's some special interest, and not to pick on the builders because I was one at one point in my life. But you know, if all of a sudden your industry is being told, oh, hey, you're going to have an opportunity to just really increase your sales and things of that nature, well, that's special interest. But I always feel that if you're running for the city of Tucson council, that your primary responsibility is to the people of Tucson. And frankly, when I walk around and I say, hey, what do you know about this thing? It's called middle housing, because it's housing that's in the middle between individual single family residences and apartments. I talk to people and 10 out of 10 go, I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah, and this goes hand in hand. Go ahead.
No, I just appreciate you bringing this to our attention over here on The Morning Voice, something that all the residents of the city of Tucson really need to keep an eye out for over there, Jay. I know you've got a hard stop. You've got a media appearance you've got to get to as well, too. And we just appreciate you bringing this to our attention here on The Morning Voice. And thanks to Mr. Jay Tolkoff, candidate for City Council Ward 6, for joining us here on The Morning Voice. Thank you, Jay.
All right, Grant, take care.
Thank you so much. Don't go anywhere, listeners. We're going to have Greg Pemberton, chairman of the D.C. Police Union, coming up after the break to talk about all kinds of interesting things happening with their police force and how that might affect us here in the Old Pueblo. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Grant Kruger. You know, when we talk local business development and economic development, you think of public safety a lot. It's been a real challenge here in the Old Pueblo, and it's been a real challenge across the nation. And we are lucky enough to be joined right now, live in the KVOI studios, by Mr. Greg Pemberton, chairman of the D.C. Police Union, to talk about what's going on in our nation's capital. Good morning, Greg.
Grant, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
No, thank you so much for joining us here on The Morning Voice. You guys have quite made a lot of news nationally in D.C. over this last month with the federal government's involvement in local policing in D.C. What's going on over there?
Yeah, Grant, well, it's important to understand how we got here. 5 years ago, our local legislative branch, the D.C. City Council, passed a piece of legislation called the Comprehensive Policing Justice Reform Act. This was a bill that was designed to defund the police, designed to hamstring cops, make sure that they were exposed to administrative, civil, and criminal liabilities, even when they went out and did their job properly. On top of that, it made sure that when we arrested criminals, even when they were convicted, it was almost impossible to hold them accountable and get them sentenced to penalties that were commensurate with the crimes they've committed. So since then, now 5 years later, we're suffering from a lot of problems. The number one is staffing. We have an authorized strength of 4,000 sworn police officers on the Metropolitan Police Department. However, we only have 3,180 as of today, leaving us with more than 800 vacancies for the position of police officer. So it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that we're going to need help from federal assistance and even the National Guard to get crime under control, because the numbers have been completely spiraling out of control for the past 4 or 5 years, and there's really nothing we could do about it. Our members, our department actually relies on 2 million hours of overtime in order to combat the crime that's out there. And it just is an overwhelming amount of work that our members have to do. And there's a lot of burnout and attrition. So we welcome this federal assistance, and we're glad that they're here to help us do this job. I think the concern for us is that it's obviously temporary. The president's authority is limited. And what we're concerned about is if these federal agents and these National Guardsmen pack up and leave after 30 days, and we haven't fixed this underlying legislation, the crime is going to creep back up, and we're going to be left with the same problem that we had to get us here in the first place.
Without a doubt, one of the things that I always think about when I think of crime are the metrics and how this is tracked. In the city of Tucson, we've often erroneously just used murder rate as an overall metric for how crime is doing. And there's so much more to it than just that, right? I always joke that 62% of all statistics are made up on the spot. And the murder rate is something that, while certainly important, it doesn't reflect just all crimes going on in a certain municipality. What metrics are you guys using right now to track whether crime is going up or down in D.C., and who's creating those metrics?
Well, one of the problems we have with the metrics is that they're questionable. In 2023, we had one of the most violent years in the past two decades. We had 290 murders. We had 960 armed carjackings. The robberies and the shootings and stabbings were off the charts into the thousands. Since then, the department has reported a 35% decrease in 24 and then another 25% decrease year to date in 25. But that information is not really marrying up with what our members see on the street, going call to call to call for all of the violence that we see on a day-to-day basis. And what we've seen over the past few months is that some local affiliates have uncovered some investigations that the police department has been manipulating these crime stats. There's actually one commander that's been placed on administrative leave and suspended because he was going into police databases and changing felonies to misdemeanors. At least that's the allegation. And we know that our members, when they respond to these felony crimes, that inevitably there's some management official that comes and tries to encourage them or even direct them in some cases to take reports for lesser offenses. So a robbery becomes a theft, a burglary becomes an unlawful entry. Sometimes even a shooting with an uncooperative victim will become an injured person to the hospital. And we're not sure that those stats are correct. And what we've seen over the past couple of weeks is that the Department of Justice has opened up a criminal investigation into those crime stats. And the House Oversight Committee in Congress has opened up an investigation into those crime stats and those reporting. So we're not entirely sure that the stats we have today are accurate.
No, without a doubt. It's one of my big concerns on this one. And of course, here in Pima County and in Tucson, we struggle from the fact that our county attorney so often doesn't prosecute to the fullest extent of the law so many of these criminal acts. And this really reduces morale of our forces that are out there on the streets and arresting people and then just having the cyclical cycle of them returning back to the street, sometimes in minutes or just hours. What can we do to increase morale for all of our first responders here in both Tucson and in D.C.?
Yeah, well, that's a great point, right? If we're going out and we're putting handcuffs on bad guys and we're bringing them into the criminal justice system only to have them come out the revolving door and go be right back out on the street the same day, laughing at the officer, that's not a great look. And so we have to hold these prosecutors accountable. We've had the same problem in D.C. Our prior U.S. attorney was only prosecuting about a third of the cases that we brought to him. 67% of the cases that he brought were dropped when they were brought in. Luckily, we have now Janine Pirro, who's replaced that person, and she's taking a much more aggressive approach, which is great. However, here in the District of Columbia, the prosecutor that charges juvenile crime is a locally elected prosecutor named Brian Schwab, and he subscribes to this theory of what we call restorative justice. Ultimately, what that means is that nobody ever goes to jail for anything, no matter how heinous the crime. And we do have a major problem with juveniles committing crimes here in the district. And so it's very hard to get a handle on that because we can go out and we can lock these kids up for carjackings and robberies and armed robberies. But ultimately, the next day, they're right back on the street with no penalties. And that is a morale issue. So the way to fix that is to make sure that citizens are holding these prosecutors accountable And if they're elected, then, you know, they should be voted out of office. And you need to get people in there that are interested in holding criminals accountable so that we can keep these neighborhoods safe.
Craig, this is music to my ears over here, and this is exactly what we're experiencing here in Tucson.
Yeah,
and
the
in
phrase
Pima County.
Restorative justice is just sadly familiar to us in Tucson, Craig. So,
unfortunately, it exists in all too many places, and it's something that we really need to eradicate, because the concept that someone has gone out and committed a crime of violence against another person and that they should just be go to an arts and crafts class or an ice cream social, or maybe they should just write an apology letter and that'll solve the problem. Anybody with a shred of common sense knows that that's not going to work, and that's just going to beget more crime once these kids know that there's no penalty for behaving that way, which, again, strains the police officers and the criminal justice system. So the way to put a stop to this is to get rid of anybody that subscribes to those ridiculous ideologies.
Without a doubt. Greg, you represent over 3,000 sworn officers as chairman of the D.C. Police Union. What are you doing to go out there to recruit? Because we're short here in the old Pueblo as well, too. We're short hundreds of sworn officers, and you're short almost 1,000. Like, what can we do to get out there to get our youth to become active, licensed first responders in some capacity?
Well, the candidate pool for people that are applying to positions in law enforcement is significantly smaller than it has been in the past. Because of all the rhetoric that we've experienced over the past 5 years, there's just less people that desire to get into the profession. But the problem here is that the people that are desiring to get into the profession are seeking agencies that are not plagued with these ridiculous, onerous policies that I talked about earlier that prohibit officers from doing their jobs and expose them to all kind of liabilities, even if they do their job properly. And that's how they shop around. You know, I'm dating myself here, but I came on the police department 20 years ago, and I was looking for the agency that paid the most. But now what these kids are looking for is they're looking for the place that's going to treat them with respect, that's going to allow them to go out and put handcuffs on bad guys, and it's going to back them up in times of stress. Many of these major city police departments, as you mentioned, don't subscribe to that, right? Police officers are guilty until proven innocent. Anytime a complaint comes in, and they're going to have to go ride the bench until they get to the conclusion of that investigation. And that's how kids are shopping for these jobs right now. That's why a lot of rural agencies don't have staffing problems, and they have more candidates than they can even fill positions for. But the major cities, they're completely suffering from these attrition numbers and these staffing losses, which is just causing brain drain and making the departments, they're bringing down their efficacy. So we've got to do something about the underlying policy that prohibits officers from doing their jobs, because that's one of the main reasons why people don't want to work here.
Without a doubt, Greg. I mean, what you're saying rings so true. It's so parallel to what we're experiencing here in Tucson as well, too. I salute you for just taking on this challenge over there in D.C. and fighting the good fight, because this is not going to be an easy battle in such a big and such an important municipality over here. We've got about 1 minute left in the segment, Greg. Any other update you want to give us from D.C.?
Yeah, you know, it's surprising to see that, you know, President Trump comes in, he authorizes these additional assistance, and we've seen crime drop dramatically. Just over the past 14 days, robberies are down 45%, carjackings are down 85%, violent crime is down 25%. Overall, total crime is down 11%. And would you imagine that? If you actually put police officers in areas where there's crime problems and you tell them to do their job, they're going to put handcuffs on bad guys and they're going to make those neighborhoods safe. And I can tell you that in just 2 weeks, a lot of these neighborhoods that felt like war zones now look like Mayberry. You can drive through there. There's kids playing. There's people walking with their children. There's people walking their dogs, hanging out in parks. It is a remarkable night and day difference in just 14 days. And this can be done anywhere. This is a policy choice, and we've got to get rid of these policies that hamstring cops.
Thank you so much, Mr. Greg Pemberton, chairman of the D.C. Police Union. Thank you for your service, and thank you for joining us on The Morning Voice. Don't go anywhere. We've got another half an hour of local news and talk coming up after the break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger, and we are joined live in the KVUI studios right now by a very special guest, Ms. Kristen Garcia Hernandez, CEO of the Girl Scouts of Southern Arizona. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning. Thank you for having having me.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us here on The Morning Voice today. Really excited to have the big boss of the Girl Scouts here with us. It's great to bring something positive up in the community as well, too, like a group that really does a lot for local girls over here. I understand you guys are celebrating a 90th year anniversary right now. Is that true?
Correct. So 90 years here in Southern Arizona. So we are just thrilled to be able to celebrate 9 decades of amazing leadership, of growing strong young women. And there's so much to celebrate.
Without a doubt, 90 years, that's a pretty incredible run.
Yeah.
How long have the Girl Scouts been around as an organization nationwide?
So well over 100 years. So Girl Scouts nationally was founded in 1912.
And that was by somebody that knew the owner of the Boy Scouts as well,
correct,
too, if I remember the legend correctly.
Yeah, you do. So Juliet Gordon Lowe was our phenomenal founder who had spoken with Lord Baden-Powell in England and said, you know what, America, our girls need this as well. So she was certainly a trailblazer, brought it back to the U.S. and ensured that girls everywhere had an opportunity to learn amazing skills and grow to be fantastic leaders.
So tell me about some of the amazing things that you do in the Girl Scouts here of Southern Arizona.
Yeah, so people often know us for our cookie program, which, you know, I love our cookie program. It's a fantastic entrepreneurship program that teaches young women incredible life skills. But in addition, we have our four key pillars is entrepreneurship, life skills, outdoors, and of course, STEM. So we want to expose girls to coding, robotics, engineering, you name it.
That's amazing. Huh. Certainly the cookies are probably the most noted element of all Girl Scout thing. I see a lot of those. They've added to my waistline over here as well. I think Matt was upset that he doesn't see Girl Scout cookies here right now in the office. What's going on? When is Girl Scout cookie season exactly?
Girl Scout cookie season starts January, and it runs January through March, and it's really what funds the organization. So it funds not only the girls' individual experiences, but it allows us to have incredible camps and properties where we can host programs throughout the year. No girl is ever turned away from Girl Scouts for their inability to afford the membership dues or the uniforms. So all of our programs, camp, all of that is accessible because of the power of the cookie. So we're grateful to have it ensure that, again, it's accessible to all.
I love it. I was a Cub Scout in a Weeblo, and I don't think we really had the entrepreneurship side that the Girl Scouts had with the cookies. You know?
I'm so sorry for you, but hey, you know, what can I say? Girl Scouts are rocking it.
Absolutely. So you're honoring 90 different women now as part of your 90th anniversary. Tell me about these honorees. Like, how's the selection process going?
Absolutely. So we thought, you know, what is the best way to celebrate 90 years and, you know, a legacy of leadership? And we thought, you know, why don't we honor 90 incredible women throughout the community that have done incredible things in their lives, whether it's been through an impressive career or they have trailblazed and have created something or are serving and or serving as fantastic role models to our young women, our next generation of leaders. So we are currently up through September 15th. Accepting nominations. So if you know a remarkable woman that you want to honor and celebrate, we welcome those nominations. They didn't have to be a Girl Scout growing up. Again, it's honoring women across the board. So those nominations are being accepted through September 15th. And we'll be highlighting them throughout the next several months and throughout the year.
I love it. So we're looking for 90 incredible women here in Southern Arizona to honor as part of the 90th anniversary of the Girl Scouts. That is so neat. Now, you're also doing 90 acts of service as well, too. Define these acts of service. Like, what's going on here with this?
Absolutely. So giving back to the community service, that's a big component of the Girl Scout world and our values. So we thought, you know, what better way, again, to celebrate than to go out into the community and continue to make a difference. So when a Girl Scout looks at a community service project, they look at it in three ways. They look, is it measurable? So can they show the impact of what they're doing? Is it sustainable? Can they ensure that after that one-time service, there will be value throughout for time to come? And is it global? And when I say global, I don't literally mean it. We mean it, is it outside of their direct sphere of their community? So are they learning something different? Are they learning something new? Are they impacting a community that they might not see on a daily basis? So our girls are invited to go out into the community and start their own project, join a project that's already in existence. We invite our community to join as well. So it could be anything from cleaning up a trailhead to painting a facility. We know funding in the nonprofit sector as well as in other community-serving organizations has certainly taken a hit. So how can we go out and support that effort?
I love it. Now, you guys, to support this effort as well, too, I understand, are doing a big live music event at Keno Stadium, something a little near and dear to my heart. I've done a music festival or two. Tell me about Scoutchella over here.
Scoutchella. We thought it would be a great way to culminate the celebrations. And so on December 6th at Keno Stadium, we're hosting a day festival in which we have three local acts, all female, of course. We're excited to feature Sophia Rankin, Mama Cole, and Gigi and the Glow for live performances. We have the stage crew set up. We're thrilled. It's going to be a full-on party. You don't have to be a Girl Scout or have been a Girl Scout to join us. We invite the whole greater community. It's about celebrating and championing female ambition and all the great leadership work that we do. So all are invited. The entire family is welcome to attend. We have festivities of all ages.
That's a great lineup. Gigi and the Glow. They do once a month at St. Philip's Plaza with us, right?
Yeah.
Headliner stage over there, one of the biggest draws we have in the plaza. Sophia Rankin and the Sound as well, too, has been an absolute great draw. They've opened up at the Dusk Music Festival a number of times, yeah. And I think they're doing Dusk this year as well, too. So they're a big draw. And, of course, Mama Cole as well, too. She plays for us over at the Maverick on the east side. I love Mama Cole. We get her in at least once a month over there, too. So this is a fantastic lineup you guys are going to have. And this is December 6th?
Correct. December 6th. It'll be from 11 to 4 p.m. So enough time to go to other holiday festivities and what have you. But yeah, a powerhouse lineup. And we're so excited. And all three acts were just so gracious and said, heck yeah, I'm on board to celebrate, you know, girl leadership. So we're excited.
I love it. How much are tickets for Scoutchella? And where can listeners go to get Scoutchella tickets so you don't have to buy them scalped on the secondary market?
Please don't go directly to us. Tickets for kids, youth, the ages 3 through 18 are $25, and for adults, $30. They are on our website. We have two websites, our main website and a website specific to this. So 90yearsstronggssoaz.org. So that GS, Girl Scouts, SO, SouthernArizona.org.
I love it. Are the cookies going to be available at Scoutchella? Like, if I go to Scoutchella, is there going to, because I know it's not January yet. If cookie
Correct.
Season starts in January, and this is December 6th, if I go, can I get a Girl Scout cookie?
That's a great question. So fun fact, cookies will be embedded a little because we're also hosting our cookie rally, our annual kickoff, if you will, to the cookie program. So yeah, we will have cookies, not for sale, but for tasting.
Ooh, I love it. What's your favorite Girl Scout cookie? If you had to pick one of the bunch, like what's your go-to over there?
Oh, that is a tough question. But I have to say, I'm going to have to cheat and say two. One, I love the traditional OG of cookies, the trefoil, which was the original cookie from 1917. That shortbread cookie is delicious. But also, I love the Adventureful, which is a brownie cookie mixed in one with salted caramel. It's delicious.
Matt, you got a favorite Girl Scout cookie over there?
So I think you mentioned this earlier. I think we might have a sleeve or two of Thin Mints in the freezer yet.
Saving
for the summer, right? And then, but the Thin Mints and they have a lemon one that I really like.
Yeah, I'm kind of a Thin Mint guy over there too. Those things are like crack. Like I can't just keep those around like my house regularly because I will literally eat all of them in one setting. It's really horrible.
I can't believe a sleeve has survived this long, but here we are. There is one. So
yeah, I love the secret stash of Thin Mints over here. You've been Bogarting those Thin Mints from me. You haven't told me at all. I come in every morning with my coffee, and little did I know within just a few years. Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
No, I love it. See, so folks, make sure you get your cookies when they're in season and they last. Just throw them in the freezer and you've got them for months to come.
Love it. Hide that stash. A great trick over there from Matt Neely, Esquire, keeping us informed on KVOI. Why don't we take a quick break over here, hear from a couple great local sponsors. And we've got one more segment coming up with Kristen Garcia Hernandez, CEO of the Girl Scouts of Southern Arizona. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Grant Kruger on The Morning Voice, 10:30 a.m. AM, your home for local news and talk. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Grant Kruger. Thank you for spending part of your Wednesday morning commute with us here on 10:30 AM. It's gorgeous outside right now. It has really cooled off these last couple days. And enjoying that cool weather is Miss Kristen Garcia Hernandez, CEO of the Girl Scouts of Southern Arizona, for one final segment with me here on The Morning Voice. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, so at the break, we were talking a bit about the impact of what the Girl Scouts do above and beyond the cookies that everybody recognizes, everybody loves, and Matt Neely's been hoarding and hiding out from me over here. Tell me a little bit about the impact that the Girl Scouts do here.
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, folks know us for our cookies, they know us for our camp, they know our uniform. But what folks might not know is that we are deeply committed to serving the entire community and ensuring every girl has access to our incredible programming. So we work with, we serve 5,000 girls annually throughout Southern Arizona. And of that, about a third of our girls we work with are through staff supported programs, where we go into underserved communities and provide Girl Scouting year round. We go into low-income areas and provide Girl Scouting weekly at after-school programs. We work with the foster care, highly involved within the foster care system, and we work with kiddos who are either in a group home or in a home placement or in kinship care. And we ensure that these girls have access to Girl Scouting, especially if they're moving from one home to another. We want the constant to be Girl Scouting. In addition, we work with girls that are involved with the juvenile justice system. So we work with girls inside juvie. We go in weekly and deliver programming. Absolutely. And we work with girls that are either out in detention or working through diversion programs. We have a fantastic relationship with the Community Justice Board. And furthermore, we work with girls whose mothers are incarcerated in the state prison in Perryville. Every other week, we go up to Perryville Prison out in Goodyear, and we go into prison and deliver Girl Scouting program with a girl, her daughter, and her mother or significant female in her life. So again, the reason why is we want to ensure that every girl has access, regardless of her home situation or regardless of what she is navigating. She has potential. We believe in her. We want to do our best to empower her to be her very best self and grow to live a life of her desires. And that's what Girl Scouting is all about. You'll see the uniform. You'll see all those wonderful badges all over their sashes and vests. And those badges represent a toolkit that allows them to live life on their terms, to be successful, to pursue higher education or pursue the career that they want or live the life within the community that they so desire. That's what we're all about.
I love that, Kristen. That's so much more than I would have thought with the Girl Scouts. When you think of Girl and Boy Scouts, you think of outdoors and camping and life skills and mm-hmm. bonding and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily think of like the penal system, right?
Right.
Like, and work, you know, in these corrective facilities. That's really amazing stuff.
Absolutely. And, you know, so much happens in one's youth. And we want to ensure that one scenario or circumstance doesn't define their potential and what the rest of their life will do, will be, I should say, and what they can do. So we are for every girl. And when you support Girl Scouts, when you buy that cookie, when you see Girl Scouts out in the community making a difference, that's what you're supporting. You're supporting a pipeline of phenomenal, strong women who are going to contribute great to this society.
I love it. So if one of our listeners has a daughter or mm-hmm. a granddaughter or a great-granddaughter even, for some of our listeners probably out there, that wants to participate in the Girl Scouts, how do they get involved? How do they reach out?
Absolutely. They can give us a call. They can call 520-326-2266, or they can go to our website, girlscoutssoaz.org. Our team would love to connect with you. There's a variety of ways to get involved. You can be involved on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, just at summer camp. You can plug into programs as you so choose. We also have Girl Volunteer Corps for our teen Girl Scouts who all they do really is go into the community and say, what are the issues at hand? How can we make a difference? And do a community service project. And they go on to the next and to the next because they have that giving, that service spirit, if you will. So again, a variety of ways for you to be involved. You can choose your own adventure. Just give us a call, connect with us, and we'd love to plug you in.
I love that, Kristen. Now, you guys have a campus here in Tucson and Midtown on Broadway as well, too. Can you tell us a little bit about that
campus?
Yeah,
absolutely. So our Broadway campus is where we have programming throughout the week, on the weekends. You can plug into astronomy nights. You can go into cooking classes and tasting. We do art. We do robotics. You name it. There's something for every girl. I love Girl Scouting because we're non-competitive. Every skill set is welcome. Every age 5 through 18 are welcome. You can join a troop or you can come as an individual girl. In addition, that's our main office, but we have two camps, actually. We have the day camp Hacienda property out on Sabino Canyon in Tanque Verde. And then on the mountain, if you want to go out and explore the pines, get out of the heat, we have a beautiful camp that we operate not only during the summer, but in the fall and the spring as well.
No way. Where in the mountains is that located, Kristen?
High in the pines.
A secret location over here. I like it. That's awesome. We'll keep it as that, the Batcave Girl Scout secret over here. You're celebrating your 90-year anniversary here in Southern Arizona. Break down the 90 years strong again for me.
Absolutely. So 9 decades of building phenomenal, strong women of courage, confidence, and character. We're celebrating in a big way. We're honoring 90 women. We are doing 90 acts of service throughout Southern Arizona and the Tucson community. And we're culminating with a fantastic music festival, Scoutcella. So Scoutcella will be on Saturday, December 6th from 11 to 4 at Keno Stadium. Tickets are available on our website. You can go to our main website. You can go to 90YearsStrong.org. Tickets for youth ages 3 through 18 are $25. Adult tickets are $30. And that entrance gets you in to see Mama Cole, Sophia Rankin, Gigi and the Glow. In addition, we'll have festivities for all ages. You name it, fun activities, lots of food. Girl Scouts love to throw a good party. So we'll make sure that you are content, that you'll enjoy the music, love the food, and get to celebrate with us.
I love all of that. I am so excited for Scoutcella right now. Like, I can't even believe it. I love the artists that you pick with that. I love the cause. I love that you're taking some time out of your Wednesday to join us over here in the KVOI studios and talk about the Girl Scouts of Southern Arizona. And I thank you so much for putting in so much time and effort to become the CEO of the Girl Scouts. Like, what a role, what an honor. And it's a real honor to have you join us here today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Grant, for having us.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us. It's been a great show today. I love that you get to spend your Wednesdays with us and talk local here on The Morning Voice on 10:30 a.m. We're going to have Kathleen Wynn coming up after the break. She's got her China Watch show coming up. Tomorrow, it's Tom Moulton from the Southern Arizona Attractions Alliance bringing you all kinds of neat things happening in the Old Pueblo. Looking forward to joining you next Wednesday on The Morning Voice. Thank you for listening and have a great day. Enjoy that fantastic weather out there and bear down on Saturday when we face the Rainbow Warriors of Hawaii at 7:30 p.m. See you out there. Thanks so much.